Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In the 21st century, the purview, complexity, and range of knowledge has changed markedly for analysts of international relations and national security. Today's security specialists still monitor possible state adversaries like Russia, China, Iran, or North Korea, or elsewhere. They also advise on pandemic disease, cybersecurity, transnational criminality, and environmental threats from extreme weather events to climate change. My guest today is a specialist on a variety of old and new threats and the evolving technologies and measures to respond to them. Dr. Dan Caldwell is a distinguished professor of political science at Pepperdine University Seaver College, where he's taught since 1978. He's also held positions at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, and in the executive offices of the president in Washington, D.C. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and chair of the Council's Academic Outreach Initiative and was a recent guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations. He's the author of co-author of several books, including Vortex of Conflicts, U.S. Policy Towards Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq, and his latest book, now in its third edition, Seeking Security in an Insecure World. He was a guest of the Committee on Foreign Relations last week, and I spoke with him while he was here. Dr. Caldwell, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
You know, for somebody who's involved in political science as you are, within the last 20 years, there's been such an incredible sea change in how you view world security and especially U.S. security. You've gone completely from state actors to non-state actors. What's the challenges for a government concerned with security of their citizens and of their vital interest in today's world with that shift of worldview? And it seemed to come so suddenly, too.
Well, for really hundreds of years, international relations was dominated by countries. And that paradigm of international relations was shattered dramatically and tragically on September 11th, 2001, when everyone assumed that the attacks had been sponsored either directly or indirectly by a country. And then it turned out that a non-state actor, Al-Qaeda, the terrorist group, had sponsored those attacks. So it caused, I think, governments and analysts like myself to shift a focus from strictly focusing on countries to focusing on subnational entities like terrorist groups. And I think in addition to that, there's been a change, too, in the focus on issues. It used to be for hundreds of years that security was defined almost solely in terms of military terms. And today, we have to look at non-military issues as well as military issues.
Give us an example of non-military issues that fall into that camp.
Well, let me give you an example from my own family history. My father was in World War II, and he participated in a very costly invasion in the South Pacific, the invasion of Peleliu, an invasion in which the Marines had a higher casualty rate than any battle in their entire history. And my father, as a naval officer, witnessed that. So the threat to Peleliu in September 1944, when this invasion occurred, was an Imperial Japanese military. If we roll the tape forward to 2016, the threat to Peleliu today is from climate change and from the rising levels of the oceans, which is literally an existential threat to Peleliu and to the other island countries, of which there are about 30 in the world, because they may very well disappear if the ocean levels keep rising.
And when we think of security issues, we don't think of environmental issues as being security issues. That's another part of the equation that has changed greatly.
Yeah, well, security, it turns out, in the research that I've done, is based on a Latin word called securitas, which means without a care. And so if we are secure, we are without a care. We're safe.
Yeah. How adept are government institutions in sort of adopting that mindset? I was thinking about just certainly, counterterrorism efforts were aware of groups like Al-Qaeda and all sorts of terrorist groups prior to 9/11. But you had a whole other range of agencies that probably weren't in that involved. How smoothly has that shift occurred over the last 14 years, or nearly 15 years now, to be able to adapt to a threat like that when the whole history of security is always dealt with state-to-state relations?
You're quite accurate that most U.S. and other government agencies weren't that concerned with the threat of terrorism prior to 9/11. Following 9/11, however, it became the principal focus, I think, of many government agencies, both in the United States government and others. And I think one of the stories that has not fully been told is the degree to which some of those agencies have been successful at foiling terrorist attacks in the United States. I've been pleasantly and very gratefully surprised that there has not been a major second terrorist attack in the United States since 9/11. Virtually everyone, George W. Bush, George Tenet, the head of the CIA, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, all the way down the chain of command, after 9/11 said, now we've got to remember that it's not a question of if there will be a second attack, but it's a question of when. And as you point out, thankfully, we haven't had that second major attack in the United States for almost 15 years now.
You know, I can remember back in the 1990s doing this sort of interview, and back then it was, they would talk about a terrorist incident. They would say it's not a matter of if, it's when.
Exactly.
Certainly 9/11 right. proved that there is. But what would you attribute that success to? Is it just the nimbleness of the security apparatus to deal with a threat, even though sometimes it has been ham-handed? I'm sure just getting on the flight to come to Tulsa here, you see some of the ham-handedness of our system, but at the same time, it seems to have done a decent job of keeping the nation secure.
I think the U.S. government deserves a lot of credit for that because they only have to be wrong once, as they were with 9/11, but they, I think, have acted effectively in terms of preventing a second major attack on the United States.
Your new book is in its third edition. It's actually, you've now revised it twice, Seeking Security in an Insecure World. How has the security issues changed over the course of this book's life?
Well, I think there have been a number of changes in terms of what we focused on and changed focus. For instance, we in the first edition did focus on the whole issue of cyber threats, but I think that the whole cyber realm has become much more important. And that's one of the paradoxes, I think, of security, because the Internet, what we now know as the Internet, started out as something called the ARPANET, which was developed by a Department of Defense agency called the Advanced Research Projects Agency, hence the acronym ARPA. And so the grandfather to the Internet was the ARPANET. And the ARPANET was developed to provide for a redundant communications capabilities among U.S. military bases and command and control centers like Washington, D.C. So it was developed originally to provide greater security for the United States and for American citizens. But now we see some 40-plus years after the ARPANET was developed that the Internet now poses a very real threat to the United States.
It's probably our greatest source of insecurity in many ways
because of
just the universal adoption of this technology.
Well, and not even a terrorist group, but an individual can use the Internet to cause a great deal of annoyance, cost, and we're on the cusp of the Internet being able to cause fatalities.
You know, a lot of times when we talk about anti-terrorism efforts, there's the other side of the coin is resiliency. And there was certainly a lot of talk, say, in the decade after 9/11 about building American resiliency, redundant systems, in which what used to be our primary systems in some cases are now our redundant systems and, you know, like hard phone lines, things like that. Are we keeping that in mind because of the fragility of, say, the cyber realm?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And I think that it raises the question of the resiliency of American citizens. And let me give you one example that is one of the great untold stories, I think, of 9/11, although it has been told in something called Boat Lift, which people can see on YouTube. After 9/11 and the attacks, there were 500,000 people stuck in southern Manhattan, 500,000 people. And so a Coast Guard lieutenant patrolling in New York Harbor tried to contact his senior officer, Coast Guard Admiral. The communications were all down, so this young 25-year-old Coast Guard lieutenant broadcast the message, all boats report to southern Manhattan for evacuating citizens. And I'm pleased to say that people responded. The U.S. government didn't have the capability to move 500,000 people from southern Manhattan out of there. Tour boats came, tugboats came, ferry boats came. And in 9 hours, 500,000 people were moved out of southern Manhattan.
Yeah, sounds like something out of Dunkirk.
It was better than Dunkirk, actually. Yeah. I mean, the distance was smaller, but in Dunkirk, it was something like 260,000 people were moved in a matter of days, not hours.
Yeah. Wow. How come nobody tells this story?
Well, as I say, there's a terrific YouTube presentation of this narrated by Tom Hanks, and I really recommend people see it. It's inspirational because it shows what normal citizens, normal American citizens have done when confronted with crisis.
Now, as I mentioned, in that first decade after 9/11, there was an awful lot of talk about resiliency. You're not hearing as much talk about that in the general media. Are opinion makers, security people, are they still looking at the state of our resiliency?
Yeah, they are. And one of the leading analysts of resiliency in the United States has a center for resiliency at Northeastern University in Boston. So there are analysts both in government and out that are focusing on that.
My guest today is Dan Caldwell, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at Pepperdine University. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, talking about Seeking Security in an Insecure World, which is also the title of his book, now out in its third edition. I assume a big issue is non-state players. You know, in the days after 9/11, after our abortive move into Iraq at the same time, the focus has been al-Qaeda. Now it seems to be ISIL or IS, the Islamic State. How good are we at actually fleshing out these organizations and understanding how they work? And are there new players in the works, if you will, that we're going to be looking at down the road?
Yeah, well, I mean,
Boko Haram, for example.
Yeah, now you make a very good point about the rise of non-state actors. I think one point to make is that there are some beneficent non-state actors as well as more malignant non-state actors. So if we think about various foundations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation that's provided several hundred million dollars for the alleviation of malaria and other diseases in Latin America, we have any number of foundations like that that are also non-state actors. But on the malignant side, you accurately point out the rise of really a successor to al-Qaeda. Just for our listeners' sort of education, the following are all the same thing. The Islamic State, as you pointed out, or the acronym IS, or ISIL, or ISIS, or the Arabic name Daesh, they're all referring to the same group, which is this very brutal non-state actor that has arisen that makes al-Qaeda, sadly, pale by comparison in terms of their use of brutality and I think also the Islamic State's ambition. They have declared a global Islamic caliphate, which al-Qaeda never did. And they are moving on that front by, for instance, forging an alliance with Boko Haram, a terrorist group that is active in Central Africa. So I think the Islamic State is a clear and present danger to a number of countries and should be taken quite seriously.
Now, you mentioned the brutality of the organization. When we think of al-Qaeda in Iraq, you know, after the fall of Iraq and then you had the Sunni elements, one of the things that sort of turned the population against al-Qaeda was the fact it's this excessive brutality in a lot of areas of Iraq. Has the same thing happened with IS or Daesh?
Unfortunately not, because
they're the only people with weapons and...
Well, the Islamic State has been very adept at using propaganda and broadcasting things like beheading or the burning alive of the Jordanian pilot that was captured. And rather than alienating people, that serves as a recruitment device. And so some of these horrific broadcasts actually contribute to more joining the Islamic State than being turned off by it. Now, the other side of the coin, though, is that when those atrocities are committed in certain areas, it leads to alienation of the local population. So we saw in Iraq, for instance, the alienation of the Sunni population in Helmand province and other in Anbar province by the atrocities committed by members of al-Qaeda. And it caused, I think, the real turnaround in Iraq when the so-called Sons of Iraq were created to oppose the al-Qaeda members, many of whom came from outside of Iraq.
It seemingly today, I think it's still debatable how the struggle is going to end, say, in Syria and this sort of area between these states that involves some Kurdish areas as well as Syria, Turkey, parts of Jordan and Iraq. But it seems like at this point the momentum is away from IS. Would you say that is the case, or is it more of a stalemate at this particular point?
The whole Syrian situation is the most complex contemporary international relations I know about because of the strange alliances. So Russia and Vladimir Putin are supporting the Syrian
government.
Dictator Bashar al-Assad, and the Iranians that the United States has not had a good relationship with ever since 1979 are opposing ISIS. So in that sense, the United States and Iran are de facto allies in opposing ISIS. So it's a very complex situation where it's hard to identify the strictly good guys and the strictly bad guys.
Let's talk about sort of the unanticipated result of this conflict in this area, and that has been the huge migration into Europe that seemingly is having a major effect on the politics of Europe. That, you know, everything from Brexit to countries that have been longing for EU membership all of a sudden saying maybe this is not the direction we want to go, and we certainly don't want to accept these refugees. And what are the tensions within Europe because of the situation, say, in Iraq, in Syria, and Turkey?
Yeah, well, you're accurate to point out the significance of that. The migration that we've witnessed in Europe is the most significant migration in Europe since the end of World War II. There were a million migrants who went into Germany, tens of thousands who went into the Scandinavian countries that typically have welcomed immigrants, but even the Scandinavian countries, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, have now shut the borders. So I think this is an issue that is of enormous significance, and the European countries, I think, are working to try to figure out what to do. But at the same time, it has increased the popularity of some of the very conservative right-wing nationalist parties. For instance, Marie Le Pen in France or the Austrian election that just took place.
Yeah, a leftist candidate won by just a...
Barely,
yeah. Yeah. And it was it would have been a major issue if the right candidate, the rightist candidate, who was very conservative and concerningly conservative in his views as far as exclusion of immigrants and the like, and anti-immigrant.
Yeah, when I was in college, I actually went to university in Vienna for 6 months, so I've followed Austrian politics, and this was to me one of the most disturbing election since the end of World War II because of the popularity of the rightist anti-immigrant candidate.
Was his views more repugnant in other areas other than just anti-immigrant? What was his views other than the immigration issue?
He's based his sort of approach on the anti-immigrant issue because that resonates loudest with, I think, Austrians. But I think there were some other elements of his platform sort of emphasizing the strength of the state as opposed to individual freedoms, things like that.
My guest today is Dr. Dan Caldwell, distinguished professor of political science at Pepperdine University. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations. Well, in addition to, you still have to, security experts in seeking security in an insecure world have to deal with state actors. They're having to deal with an increasing array of non-state actors. But as we mentioned earlier in our conversation, there's a whole range of issues from cybersecurity to climate change and also increasingly global health issues. Right. I mean, right now at this point, we're talking about a Zika virus that we're beginning to see serious public health issues involved with that particular issue. A lot of times we think of specific agencies sort of taking that on, but is the national security apparatus as a whole nimble enough to handle these huge variety of threats?
Well, I think the U.S. government has really focused and widened its focus on a number of these issues. The Central Intelligence Agency, for instance, has issued what are called national intelligence estimates on climate change, on infectious diseases, on cyber issues, and so on. And these are the highest level intelligence reports within the U.S. government. And I think not only have the Central Intelligence analysts focused on these issues, but I think they've also developed and implemented programs focusing on a number of these.
When we think of like infectious disease, we think of the CDC. Is that still the go-to point, or is it do you have, say, the CIA? Do you have the Director of Homeland Security working hand-in-hand with these organizations now?
It depends on the threat.
If it's infectious disease, for example.
Well, yeah. If for instance, let's take the Ebola virus in Africa. The CDC responded to that. At one point, the CDC had more than 200 CDC officials in Africa and in Atlanta working on trying to analyze the threat, deal with how it could best be treated, and so on. If, on the other hand, there was a suspicion that a terrorist group had unleashed a biological weapon in a city, then the agencies you mentioned, Homeland Security, the FBI, and various other teams to analyze that threat would come into play and work in coordination with the CDC.
But really, there's no overall security issues. I mean, there's liaisons, but unless there's actual threat, then those organizations don't go into play.
Well, I think they work together pretty closely focus on the likely emergence. For instance, to take one, in my view, infuriating example, smallpox was eradicated in the world through the work mostly of the World Health Organization, United Nations Organization. But in recent years, various governments, including the American government, have been concerned about the use of smallpox as a weapon. There are analyses of smallpox and then also, I think, contingency plans of how to deal with that. I'm old enough that I still have a scar on my arm from getting a smallpox vaccination. But young people today and for the last 20 or so years have not been inoculated against smallpox. So that's a case, I think, where there is close cooperation consider and think about that possible threat.
Yeah. My guest today, Dr. Dan Caldwell, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at Pepperdine University. His book now in its third edition is titled Seeking Security in an Insecure World, and that was the subject of his talk to the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations. I want to talk about a paper you did, I think it was a couple of years ago now,
right.
And it was sort of an interesting approach for political scientists. It was looking at the effect of jet lag on international negotiations, international diplomacy. Did you find that there was an effect? Does it affect negotiations?
Well, a little background. I took a class 45 years ago when I was a freshman in college from the eminent British historian Arnold Toynbee. And he gave a lecture in that class on what he thought was an underanalyzed but very significant aspect of modern diplomacy, which was jet lag. So the lecture always remained in my mind. For 45 years, this article gestated, which had to set a record for the gestation of any academic article. But I collected material over that time from memoirs and things like that, and I would interview various ambassadors and other government officials and ask them about the effect of jet lag. And interestingly, in some of the memoirs of prominent statesmen, they mention that jet lag did make a difference. For example, Henry Kissinger, in his negotiations with the North Vietnamese during the Vietnam War, flew to Paris, and he went right into negotiations and lost his temper and totally blew up the negotiations. And on the basis of that, he decided that he would never enter negotiations again without having spent a night in the area where he was going to negotiate. And I understand he still follows that rule to this day. So he was a believer in this. And then there was another interesting historical example where John Foster Dulles, in negotiating with Nasser in Egypt over the Aswan Dam, entered negotiations soon after arriving in Egypt. The negotiations fell apart. And in his own memoirs, Dulles sort of attributes that to jet lag.
Hmm. You know, it's funny. Most people, when they get jet lag, it's mainly it's like you sort of run into a wall at some point, which I suppose it could result in losing your temper, but it would be more like letting things go right by you.
That's one of the symptoms is temporary amnesia and things like that. And you don't want to have amnesia when you're negotiating.
So what was the consensus for most diplomats? I would think there would be sort of like this sort of macho thing where it's like, no, it doesn't affect me. But did they in fact say that a lot of times it does affect them in your interviews?
Well, of course, there are individual differences. We can't say that one shoe fits all or,
sure.
or one sort of phenomenon like jet lag affects everyone the same way because we all know that we're affected differently by physical aspects of medical issues. But I would say that the consensus of most of the ambassadors, government officials whom I interviewed was that, yes, it does make a difference and that when possible, they would try to at least spend a night, get outside in the sunshine and do some things like that to try to adjust. But the basic problem of jet lag is that it's caused by disruption of circadian rhythms. So even the president flying in Air Force One in his own bed still has his circadian rhythm disrupted despite the comfort of flying, sleeping in a bed.
Yeah, I think that's where the big issue would be because if you're a negotiator, you can arrange to arrive early and acclimatate. But if you're a head of state, generally you fly in, you have a whirlwind schedule, and then you fly back. I would think that there would be even a greater sense with a head of state, not necessarily the president, but any head of state.
Well, I think there is. And one of the interesting interviews I had indicated that when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, that she was traveling so much that at one point President Obama ordered her to not do as much traveling. He was worried about the effect of all the travel on her.
Interesting. Well, what was the reaction? Did you get any sort of official reaction from the diplomatic community to the article?
Only some individual responses from some of the people I had interviewed and things like that.
What did they think of the final result?
They generally were positive. I didn't get any strongly negative reviews, as I usually do.
Right. Well, we wish you great success with the next edition of the book, and thank you very much for your time today. Dan Caldwell, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Dr. Dan Caldwell is a distinguished professor of political science at Pepperdine University Seaver College. His most recent book, which is now in its third edition, is titled Seeking Security in an Insecure World. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last week. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.